Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast, September Movie of the Month. This is episode 653, and I'm your temporary host, Richard Kirkham. Temporary because the champion of the film gets to host the show. Chosen by an overwhelming vote this month, the 2000 Russell Crowe film Proof of Life was largely overshadowed by his other 2000 film, Gladiator. Proof of Life has what notoriety it does because this is the film where Crowe and co-star Meg Ryan had an affair and brought an end to her marriage to actor Dennis Quaid. We'll soon see if there's something other than Hollywood gossip to justify our attention. But before I turn the reins over to the movie's champion, let me introduce you to the cast of the show that he will be attempting to rescue. Filling in for Meg Ryan is the lone female in this macho-heavy episode. She frequently comes to my rescue on the Movie of the Month. From French Toast Sunday, welcome back, Jess Manzo.
Wait a second. I need to grab my pack of cigarettes so that I can smoke throughout this entire thing.
Yes, this is going to be a subject of discussion, I believe. Crawling out of the jungle, he's been held incommunicado in for 4 months now. Also originating from French Toast Sunday, Nick Rehak. Welcome back to civilization, Nick.
Well, thank you, sir, but I will say my beard is a little more impressive and a little better kempt.
The SAS could use a man like Stephen Palmer, because when things fall apart, he's there to pick up the pieces. Welcome, Stephen.
Well, welcome from miserable England.
And finally, he wants you to be nice until it's time not to be nice, and he knows exactly which minute that is. From the Roadhouse Minute, our champion of the movie today, Roger Wistar.
Well, thank you, Richard. This is my third time here on the Lambcast. I think that, am I in the union now?
You're a journeyman. You have to, you know, work your way up a little bit, but definitely have to pay dues.
For sure.
Well, Proof of Life won in a vote that was surprisingly overwhelming, but apparently it's quite gratifying to Roger. I know he's thrilled to talk about this movie. I'm going to turn the show over to him, and I'll be back and direct things a little bit in the second half of the show. But Roger, you're in charge now. Take over.
Thank you to everyone here for joining me to talk about one of my favorite movies. As I was joking with some friends, it's possible you may have seen on the Lamb. I may have spread the word around and got some people to vote. I'm not going to be at all embarrassed or ashamed by the 80% that we pulled down for this month, because I think this movie is great, but not everybody does. And so I think that'll be an interesting part of our conversation. But I'm so excited. Like, yeah, so you mentioned I host Roadhouse Minute with my wife, Marcy. If I could have picked any other project after that, it would have been Proof of Life Minute. But this is probably about as close as we're going to get to a minute-by-minute discussion of this lightly regarded movie. So here are my thoughts. I don't have a huge, very detailed structure. I will summarize the movie a little bit. I think it would be nice for us to kind of talk about the different segments of the movie. I think you could arguably break the movie down into kind of three different parts. But then what I'd like to do something interesting maybe with the panel here, because this movie, as I said, was not a critical success, nor was it a box office success. And so I would love for us to talk as a panel, put our movie hats on and kind of figure out how to fix this movie. Because not everybody loves it as much as I do. And I'd love to talk about that too. Here are kind of the basic details. This is Proof of Life, which you've mentioned came out in 2000. So this movie's directed by Taylor Hackford, I think a director of some renown, of Officer and a Gentleman fame. It's written by Tony Gilroy, who I think a lot of people consider to be one of the best screenwriters of his generation. Score by Danny Elfman. I mean, I'm saying those names because I feel like these are distinguished movie producers, and this should have been a better effort perhaps than it was. It stars, as you mentioned, stars Russell Crowe as a kidnap and ransom professional, Meg Ryan as the wife of Alice, the wife of David Morse's character, who gets kidnapped in not quite Colombia by not quite FARC. And it also has a memorable turn, a co-starring turn by David Caruso, who I hope perhaps some of you will have some thoughts on. So the IMDb summary, Alice, who's played by Meg Ryan, hires a professional negotiator to obtain the release of her engineer husband, who's been kidnapped by anti-government guerrillas. It's based on the Vanity Fair article Adventures in the Ransom Trade and the book Long March to Freedom, which I've just downloaded the audiobook for and am starting to listen to. Just out of curiosity, is anybody familiar with any of the source material for this movie?
Nope.
I vaguely remember the article, but
no.
That's forever ago.
Wouldn't surprise you. Wouldn't surprise me. I just want to acknowledge the fact that this movie has already been giving a loving treatment by Bill Simmons's podcast, The Rewatchables. And so if you want to know more about Proof of Life after today's episode, I encourage you to go listen to that. And I'm going to try as much as possible not to crib from their content. This movie had a budget of $65 million, but only grossed $62.5 million. So I think that officially qualifies it as a bomb. It's got a Rotten Tomatoes score of 37% and a Metacritic score of 45%. So before we get to actually talking about the movie, I guess I'm sort of curious to hear from each one of you what your experience was prior to this podcast with the movie. You know, for example, had any of you seen this movie around the time that it came out or at any time before you were brought onto this podcast? What about you, Stephen?
So for me, it was a first-time watch. I vaguely remember when it came out, but I probably remember sort of the scandal around it more than the film itself. I think also sort of Russell Crowe-wise, you know, Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan were big deals at the time, obviously with Gladiator and just Meg Ryan being the American sweetheart girl from a whole load of rom-coms. And maybe, I don't know why, it just from where I am in England, it just went under the radar.
I think even
if that's where they were having their affair.
It went under the radar for a lot of people. And we will talk about that too, because I think there's a lot of food for thought there. What about you, Jess? What's your experience with Proof of Life?
This was also a first time watch. It was one of those movies where I could swear that I maybe saw parts on TV, but then when I watched it, none of it felt familiar. So it felt very new to me. I'd heard the title, seen the cover for ages, but just never sat down to watch it until now.
And Nick, what about you? Had you seen this before?
I've never heard of this until I got the email saying, "Hey, this is the movie of the month." And I'm like, "Okay, this is what I'm watching."
And what about you, Richard?
I had heard of it, and I had not seen it for 22 years, despite the fact that it's the kind of movie that I probably would have gone to see in a theater. I can't quite remember why I skipped it. Probably a lack of enthusiastic reviews. And there were other things that were opening probably at the same time. And I just said, well, I've got priorities and this is not one of them.
Wow, so Richard, you have more backstory about The Lamb than I do. Is this the first time where I've got a fresh new panel for a movie of the month?
You know, that's a good question. I think we've had other movies of the month where everybody was seeing it for the first time, because we've had, like Nick, we've had people who've said, "I'd never heard of this movie before," but I couldn't say for sure that everybody on the panel was in that situation. I'd have to look back at it.
Okay, well, tell you what. Before we get into sort of diving into like those sort of three phases of the movie as I described, since this is fresh eyes for everybody here except me, anybody want to just kind of give a quick first take on what your experience was seeing Proof of Life? And by the way, you won't offend me. Don't worry about it. My love for the movie is not going to diminish one iota based on our recording today. So anybody, feel free to chime in. What did you think about Proof of Life?
They needed a little more editing, a little more action, and they needed to trim out a couple of the side plots to make it move a little bit more efficiently. That was my general impression. I think there's a good story here. And I think that Tony Gilroy tells a better story later on when he does some of these other movies, like the, what's the one he directed with George Clooney?
Michael Clayton?
Yes. Which was where the side stories all ultimately meant something. I just felt I went on a couple of trips here about the oil company and about the bridge and about the family relationship between Alice and her husband that really didn't go anywhere. And speaking of not going anywhere, the relationship between her character and Terry, it felt like, wait, where did that show up? You know, it seemed to me to be a place where they had found things that they wanted to have in the movie, but they put them in either in the last minute or without thinking about how it was going to fit into the movie. And so it didn't really work as well for me as it should have. That doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed it quite a bit, but it did feel clunky and piecemeal to me.
Yeah. Other thoughts?
So somewhat similar to Richard. To me, a lot less Meg Ryan, a lot more Ecuador. I was far more interested in the David Moore side of the story than I was people having telephone calls and talking bingo numbers for hours on end. And the general romantic side of thing, like Richard, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah.
Just didn't ring true. And I know that I think, as I don't know if this is apocryphal, but I think stuff was cut out of the movie because of what was going on in the background, which maybe would have helped assist that. But yeah, there's the germ of a really good movie in here. And I know being on this podcast is like birthday, Christmas and Easter for you all rolled up into one. And I don't want to ruin it for you. But yeah, I thought it was okay. But there was this, the disappointing thing is there's this seed of a really interesting movie that's hidden in a whole bunch of boring melodrama.
No, you don't worry. Like I said, you're not gonna spoil my experience with whatever your thoughts are about the movie. And you're right. I mean, it's not apocryphal. There are scenes that were filmed. You know, there is a love scene between Meg Ryan's character and Russell Crowe's character that was filmed and ultimately not included in the movie. I think after test audiences, which I agree with you, it does make their romance sort of feel weird. Like there's that scene where they have this very smoldering kiss right before Terry gets on the chopper, and you're kind of like, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm. And the whole sort of dopey eye stuff at the very end, it's like, I don't remember the relationship being like this. What's going on?
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah. So I have a very similar viewpoint as far as like the bloat of the film. There's a lot of turns that I don't think really added to it and could have been edited down some of those other parts to really develop, especially the Terry and Alice storyline. Now, I saw moments throughout the whole film of them connecting and like having small moments of, you know, that hinted at more. But I don't think it went nearly far enough to make it impactful. Like a small touch on the knee, like it was all small touches on the knee, basically. Like you needed to go a little bit more. And I think it would have made the ending of the movie land a lot more if it had. And the whole movie, I was saying to my husband, maybe they're going to hook up now. Maybe they're going to hook up now. And you know what? I wanted it to happen. I did. And it just, not in a like a romance, like I thought it would have made it more, it would have raised the dramatic heights of the movie, because what you have is a very weak love triangle. And I felt like I really did not connect to Peter at all. So like the idea, like obviously I don't want anyone to go through suffering like that, but I did not have a strong attachment to his character based on like the what we saw of their relationship before he was kidnapped. So that wasn't really working for me. So I think that was making me lean more towards like, well, what's going to happen with Terry and Alice? So there was just, it kind of just stayed at a simmer when I think they should have like raised the temperature a lot.
Yep. I mean, Peter's kind of a jerk, right? You know, like the for the 10 minutes you see him on screen before he gets abducted, you know, he's frustrated at work. He has this really kind of ugly argument with his wife. He's not very empathetic about the fact that she had a miscarriage, and then he gets kidnapped.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that that was one of the things that was problematic. I understand that you want to show that there is some tension in their relationship, because what comes later is, you know, kind of going to be more dramatic as a consequence. But, you know, when he just says, get over it, I'm just going, dude, you do not talk to your wife about an issue like that that way. That is not the way a human being that is caring interacts with somebody. And she seems to be uptight about something about his job. And he's got this idea that this is the only thing that he's ever wanted to do. And it becomes an artificial set of tension that's okay. Well, and then of course that doesn't play into anything in the rest of the film, despite the fact that it's supposed to set that up. It doesn't fuel her attraction to Terry. It doesn't justify any of the steps that she takes to get him back. It just seems like it was filler.
Nick, I don't want to make sure that we give you a chance to sort of chime in. What were your sort of first take thoughts about the movie after you watched it?
Well, my main first take thought was just it ran a little long. And I think had we cut out, but the other thing too is I'm not sure exactly what we would cut out, because if you cut out a couple things and then other lines don't make sense, you know, but if we just found a way to kind of tighten it up a little bit, maybe keep it at an hour 45, hour 50, I think it would have flowed quicker and it would have kept the tension up a little bit higher instead of having what we had where it was like kind of up, down, and occasionally losing interest, occasionally.
Yeah, I think this movie suffers from some what you see in some movies where like the rough cut of this movie was probably like 2 hours and 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they cut it, but not enough. You know, and the way they tried to cut it, I agree with what you all are saying, that they probably should have just taken chunks out of the movie. Like maybe Alice's sister doesn't need to be in the movie. Maybe there are like particular scenes that just like didn't really need to be there. And then they could have punched up some of the other scenes that like they did that thing that sometimes happens in movies where they try to trim around the edges, and then the stuff that's left kind of ends up feeling cut a little too close. Is that fair? Is that what I'm hearing from folks?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll tell you what. And we're going to get to maybe sort of what else we could have done to fix this. But just since I think there was enjoyment of this movie, at least in some sense. What I'd like to do, so I look at this movie as kind of being almost kind of three movies in one, and maybe you could say that's its problem. But, you know, if we were to kind of separate out the parts of this movie, I view it as kind of falling into three buckets. And so what I'd like to do is just kind of talk about each one and maybe talk about the parts of those sections that we liked. And then maybe we can talk about how to fix this movie. So the three kind of major categories that I would see are one, Peter's abduction and captivity, which is kind of one plot arc. And then two, Alice and Terry attempting to negotiate for Peter's release. That's more or less kind of the middle of the movie. And then the third part is when, you know, Terry and Dino go on their commando rescue mission. Does that seem fair? Like, is everybody kind of with me that those are kind of three major segments of the movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I you could say they are almost the acts of the film, but I think you've picked out the three things that need the most attention.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so the captivity part for sure overlaps with kind of the negotiation part, but I think in our mind we can kind of tease those out because they do take place in different locations. So let's start with Peter. And I guess my just sort of general question to folks is like, what parts of that, even going all the way back to where he gets kind of taken in his car, like what were the parts of that segment of the movie that we enjoyed the most?
I think I just liked watching his entire arc. He goes from just being so confused and being like, why are you taking me? What are you doing? To getting to a point where he just doesn't care anymore. Because you can see when he's kind of having a showdown with that guy, and he's like, "And shoot me." He's like, "Give me 5 minutes alone without you, without your gun, and I'll show you what's up." To finally getting a bit of, I don't know, just some semblance of, I can actually get out of here. Like, let me stay strong for a little bit longer. I've got a plan. I'm going to get out of here. So seeing how his character went through all of that, it made me start to feel for him a little bit, even though he goes from being like a real jerk and a monster to Meg Ryan. Now it's like, okay, I'm not forgiving him for what he said, but I can understand the stresses he was under and how he's becoming this person and what he's going to take away from it on the other side. So seeing that, I really dug it. And I dug the landscape. You know, a lot of it felt like, what is it, Malick's Thin Red Line, you know what I mean, with the hills and the distances and things like that. But it was just like kind of nice to look at sometimes.
So, Nick, I will just interject real quick with just a piece of information because I think it adds to what you're saying. So Peter's part of the movie is very obviously based on this book, Long March to Freedom, who I should have the author on hand, but I don't, which is a first-person account of what it's like to be held in captivity. And one of the things that I think is interesting about that book is that the author says very clearly from the top, like, it was very important to me that I maintained my dignity and that I didn't sort of lose it. And I would say one of the things that I like about Peter in this movie is that, you know, even from the beginning, like even from the part where he says, like, you know, wait a minute, let me have a picture. Or there are many other parts sort of during his captivity where, you know, he does not give in to fear, or at least not visibly to his captors. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, that picture thing kind of surprised me, because that's not really something you see in a lot of other movies where someone is kind of taken hostage or held captive. Like, they don't get to have that one thing, and he was able to. And of all the things that happen in the movie, like, that sticks out to me the most.
Well, I think the whole experience of being taken in that situation, and he ends up with a whole bunch of other people who are also taken captive, and then they kind of go through this sorting process. That's the scary part. You get, well, why are some people being sorted this way and being tossed aside? Some are being released and some are being held. Obviously, he's, you know, an American in this situation. He stands out like a sore thumb. So there's going to be a lot of attention to him. And they've got this idea about, you know, they see his ID card and assume that he's working on the oil pipeline, because, you know, what he is doing is, in essence, political cover for the oil company. And so that makes him a bit of a target. But he always acts, and I think that's one of the things that makes him sympathetic in the part of the film where he is a captive. He always acts as if, you have made a stupid mistake. I'm not the one that you want. You are going about this the wrong way, and I'm barely tolerant of the fact that you are idiots.
We know what it's going to be like when you get kidnapped.
Yeah, I'll be dead.
Better you'll just have bruises all over your face.
He does speak pretty boldly to them.
Yeah.
Well, I think that isn't that because he realizes he's actually in a position of some power, because they're only going to get money if he's alive. So I think at that, although that somewhat backfires on him later, I think he believes that for a certain point of the film, he actually has some power here. I enjoyed that bit of the movie, apart from, I wish they hadn't made him out to be quite such a selfish prick at the beginning. And because it took a long time to get sympathy for him again. And also the movie kind of sort of disses the fact that he might have been affected by the miscarriage as well. So it is a bit clunky, I think, in introducing that as a schism in their relationship. And I also didn't understand the point. There's an Italian guy that we talk about a lot that we don't meet to the rescue. That was a bit weird as well. But the Peter Moore segments of, and Ecuador is just beautiful, even like when it's cold and he's in a tiny little tent on a hilltop in his transition. I just thought, oh, I really want to go to Ecuador. It looks fantastic, but I don't want to be kidnapped.
Yeah, it's funny. So the real Peter actually worked not for an oil company, but for an NGO that was attempting to kind of improve agriculture in Colombia. And so that's where you get that sort of in a sideways sort of way with this dam project. But like in the book, he's trying to say to his captors over and over again, like, look, I'm trying to help you guys grow more food. I'm not the person you want to be holding in captivity. But yeah, we don't get quite the same impact here when he's working for Big Oil.
Yeah, we also haven't really touched on the whole opening sequence of the movie to introduce Terry's character with the whole Russian Chechnya operation, which to me, that really set the tone of the movie that I really went into this thinking it was going to be more along the lines of like a 90s thriller. And it is much more of a drama than a thriller to me. It's a lot more serious than I expected it to be. And I felt like watching that opening sequence, I instantly kind of got the gauge for what to expect for the movie.
So Jess, your vote would be to keep the prologue.
I don't know.
Without the prologue,
the fact that we haven't brought it up until this point, yeah. I think means something that we weren't all instantly like, that was amazing. That was so cool. I think that says something, but I do think it set the tone for me of what I was getting into in the movie, for better or worse.
And without
it wasn't that a bad prologue. Scene, but yeah. I don't know that it necessarily contributed a ton overall.
But without that prologue, the descent into Rambo 2, which it becomes at the end, doesn't make any sense. Because if you didn't have that, you would wonder why they've suddenly gone from negotiating on the phone and a little bit of political stuff to full-on Green Beret, which was... I know it's all set up that he's in the SAS and David Caruso and all that stuff is going on, but it is a real jarring change. And without that setup at the beginning, which I was quite good, apart from... tanks versus men is just a non-issue, seriously. Just get too close to them and they're useless anyway. But I kind of like that bit, and actually the rest of the film sort of slowed down a bit too much for my liking.
There's a funny piece of trivia from that scene which I have heard secondhand, that part where you see Russell Crowe jump on a helicopter, he is not wearing a safety harness in that scene. Apparently, he is essentially holding on to the strap that he holds on to keep him holding on to the skids of the helicopter. And that's the only thing keeping him from, not being able to film the rest of the movie.
Yeesh.
I think he was quoted in an interview several years later saying that's by far the dumbest thing I've ever done on set.
He was really Tom Cruise-ing it.
Well, I think we're hitting a little bit on one of the reasons that the film didn't succeed. Steven mentioned it, it does get into this Rambo 2 kind of area. And I think that that's the way it was set up and kind of sold, that we're going to be getting this action film. And there are really only the two major action beats at the beginning, at the end. And then there's a little teeny section right in the middle where he confronts the negotiator that it is the second choice, the fallback.
Which is a fantastic scene. That's one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie.
It's a very good scene, but it's completely unnecessary. If you were going to cut things out, you'd cut all of that out, made Terry, in charge from the beginning, and just followed that trail to how they negotiate and move on. But it's, like I said, it goes in a lot of different directions and brings up things that are interesting ideas, but I'm not sure that they're as cinematic as they need to be.
Well, let's talk about that sort of muddled middle that I'm sort of hearing from folks. This is the part of the movie where Terry comes back and he's working diligently to negotiate Peter's release, right up to the point where essentially the captors go radio silent, which is sort of the big middle part of the movie. This is theoretically when Terry and Alice become romantically involved. What did we like from that section before we talk about how to make it better?
Well, you just said it, that's a great scene that he has with the other negotiator, the local guy. And I'm probably conditioned by too many of these cartel movies to think that everybody is ultimately just a asshole who's trying to get you. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, this is not a sincere effort. He's just going to take the damn money.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that that's an accurate representation of what's going on. It could be. It could have been that he was sincere in this process. I don't know. But it didn't really seem to be serving the main plot very much. It was just a kind of, well, what can we have Terry do other than get on the radio and keep in contact with somebody? We got to have this little confrontation in the middle here.
I mean, I think the middle part of the movie is sort of clearly designed to show you how the kidnap and ransom business is sort of that it's not Rambo, that it's a lot of negotiating. Right. And I think it's also sort of supposed to show you the arc for Alice, you know, what she has to go through. How did we feel about Alice's development as a character from, you know, during this part of the movie when Peter gets taken right up until Kiss and Get on a Chopper?
I felt like for me, I don't know, I didn't feel like much. I felt like she was just fairly distraught the whole way through. She had her ups. She had moments where she was, you know, feeling a little bit good. She had moments where she was like, I got to get away from what they're saying. I can't be looking at this right now. I can't. She handled the stress as best as she could at certain times, but I never felt anything of like, you know, oh, this is her character at her peak. Oh, this is the character at her lowest. Like, it just felt like, you know, this is how someone would react to a situation like this. It would kind of be, you know, you got your good days and your bad days, but it wouldn't be anything so dramatic and over the top.
It seems
which
like
I liked.
It seems like she processes a lot through nicotine. And I know, Jess, that was kind of your intro. Do you have a take on Alice's smoking?
It's just in the year 2022, when you see movies where people are just smoking nonstop, it really does just bring you back to that time where, you know, there were smoking sections in every restaurant. And I feel like now if someone was smoking through a whole movie, it would almost be like a judgment, like a sign of something. But back then it was just like, that's what you did. You just smoked constantly. And I even read when I was reading up just after the movie, I saw a random quote from Russell Crowe saying that he smoked 60 cigarettes a day. That measure.
as an ex-smoker who was smoking at the time, I found it incredibly distracting. the nicotine pangs are coming up because seeing Meg Ryan smoking, that's quite shocking as well. It's not as bad as Gwyneth Paltrow in Sliding Doors, where she famously smokes a cigarette back to front. But it was a bit odd and unnecessary. Did they even show the pack? You know, was it subliminal advertising, or was she just waving a cigarette around all the time?
You never see anybody without a cigarette already ready to go.
It was very strange, and it was very, and it was Meg Ryan trying to harden up her attitude or something. I don't know. It was weird.
Sorry, go ahead, Jess.
Oh, sorry. Like, they gave her not a decent amount of plotting necessarily, but a decent like range of emotions to express during that time. Like, certain times she's very like hardened and holding it together. She has her moments where she's crying and feeling the full weight of the emotion. But I do wish they gave her a little bit more of like interior to who she is. Cause you get this like, oh, she's a hippie. Like, they kind of drop that a couple times, and you know, she goes out in public not wearing a bra. So I guess that's supposed to like, you know, round out her character or something. But like, I don't know if the cigarettes were supposed to be like part of that.
Were they meant to counter her perfect hair and makeup that she had all the way through a particularly depressing period of her life in the heat of Ecuador? I don't know.
It's interesting because, I mean, so maybe this is the time not to talk about Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan, but just to talk about, like, this is a very different Meg Ryan from what we were used to at this point. Maybe that's another reason why this movie was not a commercial success. How do we feel about this Meg Ryan? Because this movie is literally the next major release after You've Got Mail. How do we like this Meg Ryan?
Well, obviously she doesn't exude the charm that she did in all the rom-coms in the previous decade. She's acting a dramatic part, and I think that she does fine, but it's not what audiences necessarily see in her as an actress. She does have the ability to hold the screen, but to keep a story going, you need to have a little bit more personality. And I didn't really feel like there was that much to her personality except for being distraught.
I mean, it was fine. I've never really felt any particular way one way or the other against Meg Ryan. I was just like, oh, okay, it's Meg Ryan. Like, I will say this, though. They did mention the hippie thing earlier. I'm not glad out of nowhere she just pulled out a joint and she's like, you need to unwind a little bit. Like, I'm glad they just kept it at cigarettes and stuff. But yeah, I was like, I'm like, yeah, this is fine.
I think they could have tapped in, obviously not gone like full rom-com with it, but she does have a knack for having chemistry with people. They could have ramped that up a little bit more between her and Terry.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think they had chemistry at all, which is the most ironic thing in the world, yeah. Bearing in mind what's going on in behind the scenes. And I wonder, has it been edited to stop them having chemistry? I don't know. It's just weird because this is Sally. This is, you know, this is, she's the greatest rom-com actress of her era, right? Sort of the 90s. Could she be so horrendously miscast? That just can't be true. Therefore, something else has got to be going on here.
I think part of the answer to that question is I think they did cut out. I think they did make cuts to curb the chemistry as a result of what was being reported happening off screen, which is, you know, it's too bad. That seems super unfair, I think. You know, obviously we're not as enlightened now as we were back then, but you know, maybe this is the time. So let's talk about this famous one of the more notorious off-camera romances. You know, before that, you got to go back to you know, Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, or you know, other things like that. Obviously, this became a big deal, and this is like before like social media and stuff like that, and it was still a big deal. This is the romance that broke up Meg Ryan's marriage with Dennis Quaid. So, I mean, I sort of have two questions about that, which is like, is it fair for us to even pay attention to these things? And more to the point for us today, is it fair for us to let that stuff affect our opinion of the movie?
Well, this can be probably a more like equivocal time as what's going on with Don't Worry Darling, because I can't remember the last time a movie before it's released has had this much drama associated with it. So it's hard to separate it, but I think for me I would like to separate things like that when I watch it and give it a shot for its own and not buy in too much to like the salacious thing elements that like outside of the movie. It's hard to do that, though.
I mean, I guess we had it also with Jiggly. Is that what it's called? The Affleck Lopez movie had a similar sort of thing going on.
Jiggly,
yeah. That's how you say it. Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to enjoy it a lot more if I watch it and pretend that it's called Jiggly.
Jiggly.
That puts such a smile on my face, Stephen. I needed that.
You'll be expecting something different.
And you can edit that out or keep it in. I don't care. But the point is, it does happen on occasion. But this was a big. I mean, even I remember. And obviously, because they were running around London, it was reported in our tabloids, and our tabloids at the time are very different to what they are now. They've had a. Well, they're basically irrelevant these days, and now it's all social media and the like. And I think it would be fascinating to know what it would have been like if social media was what it's like now. And the thing is, like the question you posed, Roger, was should you take the movie as an isolated thing, or do you also include everything that's going around the outside? And I guess for a lot of us that enjoy movies and stuff, we enjoy the making ofs and we enjoy the scandals and we enjoy all that kind of stuff. And there is a voyeuristic aspect to it, right? You're all going to disagree with me, but I'm not against that.
So in a weird way, sort of like driving past a highway accident or something, perhaps this affair enhanced your enjoyment of the movie.
Potentially. I did spend an hour and a half yesterday going through loads of old... We're trying to work out the story and actually they've sort of released bits of the story over time. You know, it doesn't sound like her marriage with Dennis Quaid was particularly strong anyway, and this wasn't necessarily the thing that broke it. There's all kinds of things like that. What I would also say is I thought there was no such thing as bad publicity. I don't understand why this would have stopped people going to see it. Was the world that different in the year 2000? Because I'm pretty sure people go and see stuff like that because there's gossip and it's all part of the cycle. I do know that they chose not to go to any junkets, which I think the director says hurt it a lot, but it shouldn't have hurt it. It, you know, in my experience of everything else, nothing juicier than a scandal to get people into the cinema.
I think you're selling this movie on the basis of stars, and your two stars are not available to promote it. The two stars have negative publicity about them as a consequence of what's going on here. One of the stars has an image in the public's mind that is at the opposite end of what's going on. Those are things that, when you say, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity, the world is full of people who are not working currently because of bad publicity.
Yeah, so I want to echo Richard's point there, and I think it's particularly true with Meg Ryan, although I would say perhaps it's generally true, sad to say, probably more with female actors than male actors. You know, I mean, another classic example of this was with Brad Pitt on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. You know, a lot of people say that that movie broke up his marriage to Jennifer Aniston. I do not remember him getting dragged through the tabloids like Meg Ryan probably was. And I don't know if that's because she was a woman or because it was, you know, America's sweetheart. But I think all of that contributed to the problem.
And I think you're right. You know, one of the problems we have today, and you might want to bleep this out, but it's slut shaming, isn't it? And it's we hold women to a completely different standard than we do to men, especially famous people, right? And maybe that hurt it. Did it hurt Meg Ryan's career? I don't know.
We are seeing her. One could argue we're sort of seeing her like the she's just crested over the apex of her career, and it's gonna start going downhill from here.
Yeah, I think that people also. I do think it does happen more with female actors, but people create a very distinct idea of them in their mind and don't allow them to be three-dimensional people sometimes. Like if you have such a strong image like she did. And I don't know, Stephen, I was doing the same scholarly research as you were yesterday, diving into the history.
Into the scandal sheets, yeah.
Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid's marriage, but it sounds like he was quite a poor husband towards her. So, but that kind of thing doesn't really, you know, come into play until, you know, the fallout, you know, sometimes years later where, you know, you look back at these figures and you see they had more, you should have had more empathy towards them at the time than people, and especially tabloids and now social media really allows people to have. But I don't know if I doubt like Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan had quite the same like sort of favorable look upon their marriage as like you said, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. I feel like people had a very like parasocial attachment to that marriage that it really like made people angry when that happened. I don't know if that's, I know it was a scandal for her marriage to end, but I don't know if people had that kind of like view of their marriage.
I'm trying to come up with an equivalent analogy just sort of as a thought experiment to flip the genders. And so I'll just put this out here, and you don't have to comment on this if you don't want to. Like if we had found out in the tabloids in 1993 that Tom Hanks had slept with Robin Wright Penn and that broke up her marriage to Sean Penn, would that have done similar damage to that movie because we think of Tom Hanks as the Marble Man?
I think it would have colored the view of that movie for sure. I think people might not have like been able to see the character of Forrest Gump as quite so like, I guess, innocent, if you will.
And well-meaning, yeah.
Obviously, it has nothing to do with the character, but people have a hard time separating things. Like it wouldn't have made him look as squeaky clean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can love you, Robin. Sorry.
I'm not a smart man, but I do know that you don't cheat on Rita Wilson.
Oh man. Okay, well I think Before we maybe sort of bring this discussion of the movie to a close, there is a third segment of the movie that we haven't really touched on, which is our commando raid in the last third of the movie. What did we enjoy about that section where we go to rescue Peter and the Italian?
I liked how clean it was. I know it's a weird thing to say, but I like that they stuck to it. They stuck to their code names. They had their little maneuvers. They knocked it out. They did it and they got back. Nobody was off playing wild card. Nobody got loose and was just killing people left and right willy-nilly. Like, even before even pulling the trigger, every time he had a chance, the guy was like, what are we doing? And he was like, all right, let's just go. But they stuck to it. They didn't just go. I mean, yeah, at times it feels like they just went wild and did whatever they wanted to. But it was still confined within the thing. And I don't know, it just felt controlled, like a controlled chaos kind of thing.
It felt like it was planned, which I understand most military maneuvers are. And sometimes when you watch something and some hero goes off script, you think, well, what I feel about any of the Top Gun films, just it's not going to happen, guys. That's not how the military works. And I know this wasn't the military, but the guys are ex-military, yeah? And it wasn't too long. It was suitably bloody. It was suitably full of the confusion, the fog of war. You know, our hero gets blinded, well, at least temporarily. It would have been pretty cool if he'd stayed blinded. That would have made the film super interesting, but never mind. But yeah, I was cool with it. It was, you know, we talk about it's not really the last third of the film, is it? It's like the last 20 minutes. And I enjoyed that, Ben. I'm not normally a person who likes that kind of thing. So I just think it had the right scale, the right, what I feel to be realism. Obviously, I've never been in the SAS. I don't know. But it felt, I enjoyed it, surprisingly, against my usual judgments.
There's a very good sense of professionalism that's going on in that, with that group of four guys that are going in to do this mission. And they all act like they know what their role is, who they're answering to, what their objective is at any particular point. And like you said, nobody's going off script. They're just trying to get done what they're supposed to be getting done. And I know Caruso gets a lot of crap around the world for all kinds of things. I thought he was really good in this segment where he plays somebody who really is on top of it. And when he runs into a frustration, he responds in a way that the frustration probably would be seen by somebody in that particular circumstance. I thought all of the people who were in that commando unit, as small as it was, gave us the kinds of character that we needed to have just as much as was necessary to carry off the scene without turning it into, well, everybody's got to have their own little story arc and a little bit of drama to go along with what's happening. It was really about the mission.
Jess, you really liked the prologue. What did you think about the end of the movie?
I mean, it definitely heightened the tone of the movie from, you know, the negotiation point that felt very, like, slow moving. So in that way, it definitely felt like it ended the movie in a much more exciting way than if, like, they were like, okay, we accept your terms, and then they just get him back. I mean, that could have had its own, you know, way of excitement, but it definitely would not have been near what this action scene was. And I feel like they were giving what they would think the audience would want in it.
I think that's totally fair. Well, tell you what.
And nobody was surprised, of course, when Peter gets a gun in his hand, what happens with that gun.
Yeah, it doesn't work out too well for my man, Waco.
You could see that coming from real one.
Sure. Well, before we get to our lamb scores, does anybody, and thank you all. I appreciate you digesting and dissecting this. It's only enhanced my enjoyment of this movie. Before we get to the lamb scores, anybody have any kind of closing thoughts?
I have one. It's more of a nitpick. They did know that Russell Crowe's from New Zealand, not Australia, right? This obsessive bit in the story where he keeps going on he's Australian. He would have still been allowed in the SAS. It's still in the Commonwealth. I don't know what that stuff was going on with his son at school.
where he's at some high public school where he calls his dad sir, because, and then just to show that he really did like rugby, was good at it, he explained it again later on. However, it did give me my favourite line of the year, which is, "No, mate, I'm for real." And I'm going to be getting that and putting that as my ringtone for a while, because that's hilarious.
Any other closing thoughts?
Well, I am a fan of Pamela Reed as an actress. And when she showed up in the film, I said, "Oh, this will be interesting." And then she disappeared. And I said, "What happened?"
Got to go back to Dallas.
Yeah. And it's a perfect example of something that could have been cut out of the film. That whole thing, they could have had one phone call. They could have done the whole thing with Meg Ryan on the phone to somebody that we don't see, about how difficult it is to get the money and how desperate the other person is to help out. And we didn't need to have all the other plot lines that, or, you know, storylines. I don't say plot lines because they really aren't relevant to any of the plot, but the little side moments, the confrontation between her and between the two women, for instance, mm-hmm. That's why is that there? It's again, an example of, there's stuff in this movie that doesn't need to be there, and they give it more attention and they play it better than it should have been done. You know, what's the old saying? I'm not sure there's anything worse than doing well that which shouldn't have been done in the first place.
Yeah.
I think this movie has a real, like, use it or lose it thing going on, where it's like, okay, you have the sister character, which I think I also like that actress, and I wouldn't have been interesting if she stayed around and she noticed Alice and Terry connecting and she had, you know, there was a bit of tension there. Or there's this scene, there's the whole, like, Marco is a government official. Well, that's interesting in the sense of, like, oh, there's corruption, but if that's all that's gonna amount to, just scrap it, because it didn't do enough to be there. There's a lot of little things along the way that's like, either use it well or just scrap it, because what you have is you're taking all these moments away from grounding, like, what the true story is, which is the negotiation and the quote unquote love triangle that's developing, that's never quite made it. But I mean, I don't know if this is when the love scene would have happened, but when the moment where she believes Peter to be dead, I totally thought that that's when their relationship was going to culminate. And I feel like, how much more of a dramatic stake would that ending have if they had actually, like, gone all the way there, and then she has to wrestle with the fact that her husband actually was alive. And I feel like it doesn't go far enough to make that ending what it is. And honestly, that ending has notes of Casablanca in it.
Yeah, that's, like, exactly what I was thinking. It's like a poor man's Casablanca. But
you don't get all
Dino
the
are gonna have a beautiful friendship.
It could have been there, but it didn't get there.
Nick, any final thoughts?
I thought it was fine. Could have used a little bit of editing, and I kind of want to see the parts that they cut out.
Well, Richard, I think it's time for us to give our lamp scores from 1 to 5. Yes,
lamp scores. And make sure everybody does 1 through 5, and you can have a half a lamb. But if you start quartering it, that's too much.
So, Stephen, let's start with you.
So it wasn't horrible. It didn't make me angry, which some films have been doing a lot recently. And I didn't fall asleep while watching it. All right. And I do think there are two really good films in here that someone else could have made with the two storylines and looking at things differently. So I'm going to give it a 2 out of 5. But don't think that that's fairly average for me. So yeah, I can understand why you like it, but just too many frustrations for me. So 2.
Richard, how about you?
I'm going to give it a 2.5. I now understand why I didn't rush out to see it. I'm not sorry that I waited 22 years to see it. I'm glad that I did see it. I enjoyed it while I was watching it, but it's unfortunately forgettable for me.
Jess, how about you?
I'm going to have to go, oh, you're so nice. I feel so bad. I wish you were kind of a jerk, because then I would be like, I don't feel so bad not liking this movie that you love so much. But, you know, we all have those moments where we swear by a movie and other people just don't see it the way you do. But I'm going to have to go with a 2 on it. It's not dreadful, but it really just did not work for me very well.
Just that's fine. I thought with that preamble, you were going to come in with like a half. Those would have been fighting words, but 2 out of 5, that's almost half. And Nick, how about you?
I'm going to go with 3 Margot Martindales out of 5.
Very good. Well, Richard, I'm not sure I should rate the movie that I championed unless you really want me to.
Well, if you think that we're going to let you get away without rating it, you are sadly mistaken.
Okay. You would. I don't want to risk getting taken up into the Andes and put in a tent. This is not a perfect movie. I mean, I'm not claiming that this is on the same level as Gladiator or anything, but this is a movie that I just enjoy the hell out of. I will watch this at any time. And so I'm going to give it a 4. I agree with you that there certainly are things that could have been done to make it better, but there are so many parts of this movie that I just love so much, many of them involving David Caruso. And I don't think we have time to get into that right now, but he must have gone on a diet after this movie, after all the scenery that he was chewing. I'm going to give it a 4.
Well, we've had an enthralling discussion of Proof of Life, and I don't know that this discussion has given us enough proof of life of this movie that you should go see it, but I'll tell you what, we seem to have gotten to a consensus with one exception. So
I did say to my husband last night after we finished watching, I was like, Meg Ryan was Russell Crowe's Proof of Life all along. that's what it was. Also, this is the 3rd Russell Crowe movie of the month in like the last year. So there's The Quick of the Dead and LA Confidential.
Didn't he have a cameo in Koyaanis Kotsi?
I don't remember, but if you did, we're suddenly going to have to make sure that we exclude him from movie of the month selections from now on. All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back for some rants, raves, and reviews.
Why This Film Podcast looks back at the movies of your childhood. Join me, Emily Slade, each week as I step back in time to revisit the films that you grew up with. Maybe you haven't seen it for a while. Maybe you watched it every day since you were 8. Maybe you totally forgot it existed. Whatever the movie, I'm here to go back with you through nostalgia untold and memories unnumbered. Together, we'll ask, why this film?
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place!
We've returned for our rants, raves, and reviews of the week, and everybody's got something that they want to talk about. Nick, let's start with you. Are you ranting this week? Are you raving? Or do you have a review for us?
I'm raving, Richard. I went to this restaurant the other day. No, I'm very, very excited. I got an email on Friday. The Criterion Collection is adding WALL-E in November. It's going to be spine number 1161. I am a big Criterion person. I got the Criterion channel. I love flipping through on that. I'm sure if Howard Kasner was on the show, he'd be talking about a series or something coming up on the channel that he's very excited about. But I think this is kind of huge to have such a powerhouse studio like Disney giving one of their, not giving, but kind of leasing one of their properties and letting another company altogether kind of handle the presentation and release of it. It's going to be on 4K, and the film is insanely gorgeous anyway. So to see it on a 4K presentation with the Dolby Atmos, the HDR, and so on and so forth, I think it's going to be just even more spectacular. I even hit up Jay, who's a huge Wally fan, and he said to me, the Wally Criterion Collection looks good enough for me to finally own something from the Criterion Collection. So that puts a little bit of a smile on my face. But it's definitely, it's a day one buy for me, and I'm looking forward to rewatching it when I get it.
Criterion and Disney, thank you for the advertising. Steven, are you promoting something that you want us to see? Are you trying to warn us against something? What's got you going this week?
I don't know. I'm really confused whether to pimp something or to rant or to rave. And you know what? Let's be positive because I feel I've been a bit negative today. So I was going to go on a big rant about Thor, Love and Thunder.
Aww.
But I know you've only just done a show about that, so I will. But what I did see was a film I didn't know I wanted to see, that I didn't know even should have existed, and surprisingly really enjoyed. I'm talking about Orphan First Kill. The original Orphan film is fine. It's got a funny old twist. I guess you can't spoil movies that are like 12 years old, can you? And hilariously, with my Asian Cinema Film Club hat on, there was a film called Murderer, which took exactly the same twist. So they rip them off all over the place. However, I stumbled across Orphan First Kill, and I just thought, what is the point of this? it's a prequel to a movie that no one wanted a prequel to, that I was aware of. And to be fair, the first half, other than a little section in a Estonian asylum, which is kind of interesting, just retreads the first film with different people. And then there's this twist, and I had no idea I wanted Julia Stiles to be a crazy soccer mum. And it was brilliant. And I really, really enjoyed it against everything. But I don't even know why I started watching it. But I would really highly recommend it if you like your horror a bit high camp and silly, and that they use practical effects instead of uncanny valley CGI. So, yeah, watch that if you've been not wanting to watch it for very good reasons. It's way better than you might expect.
All right.
Mixed messages, but still a recommendation. I like it.
Oh, that's me all over. You're never going to get a straight answer from me.
Roger, what did you want to tell us about?
Well, thank you. So I love documentaries and I love sports. And so I want to commend to all of you a new series of sports documentaries on Netflix called Untold, I think is the overall title. This is an amazing series of documentaries, and I think the way that each film is constructed, both in terms of the extensive sit-down interviews they get with people who you never think would talk on camera, but the subjects that they tell, and they do that thing that I think every great documentary does, which is take a subject you thought you knew and show you very quickly that you knew nothing about that. So the four episodes that I've watched are the one about Manti Te'o, the Notre Dame player who was catfished, one about Tim Donaghy, the NBA referee who was betting on games, the Malice at the Palace, which was a very famous fight at an NBA game. And then the one I just watched was about the America's Cup in 83, which where the Australians, sorry, not New Zealanders, the Australians beat the Americas to win the cup for the first time in its 132-year history. So any one of those episodes is brilliant, and I cannot wait. It is the legitimate successor, I think, to 30 for 30.
I have also been watching through those, and they are great. And just sit down for Crimes and Penalties, because that one is an awesome ride. But yes, I also watched the Manti Te'o and the Tim Donaghy one as well. And I agree with everything you just said. They're very, very well put together.
Well, it sounds interesting, and it's definitely I would call it a rave. You guys are very enthusiastic this week about things. That's great. Jess, what are you going to continue this trend? Are you going to be giving us something positive, or do you have something that's going to piss us off?
I'm also positive. I almost did go with Untold, but I was like, let me go with something else. And it's a show that just wrapped up on Peacock. So a million streamers, but if you have access to Peacock or can get the show, I recommend The Resort. It just wrapped up. It's 8 episodes, short episodes, very easy watch. It stars William Jackson Harper, who was in The Good Place, and Kristen Melody, who was in Palm Springs and the last season of How I Met Your Mother and a few other things. I think she is spectacular. And it's a story. They play a married couple that go on a vacation and end up finding a thread to a mystery that they decide to unravel. And it is pretty delightful. It has a very, it's got a comedic tone to it, but it also has a very interesting mystery. It takes some interesting turns along the way. And if you like one of those mystery shows where it just builds on everything, as long as you don't expect, you know, 100% of the threads to be answered. I mean, I think that's a tall order at this point. Most mystery shows are not quite getting there, but as long as you don't expect that, I think that you will probably enjoy this show.
I'm going to do a rave about something that I haven't really seen or read yet, but it comes from a fellow lamb, and I want to promote it early so that people are thinking about it. Kristen Lopez, who is one of the lambs that's been around for quite a while, has written a book that is going to be published under the auspices of the Turner Classic Movie Series. It's called But Have You Read the Book? It's 52 literary gems that inspired our favorite films. And it's coming out next year, but it's available for pre-order now. And Kristen and I don't always agree about movies, but we've had very good conversations on The Lamb, and I know that she's an excellent writer. So I would strongly ask people to go out there and look at it. If you are interested in classic films and you are interested in literary sources, this sounds like it's right up your alley. I think it'll be a lot of fun, and I hope that Kristen has a very successful publication with this. You know, I'm a TCM fan. I love old movies, and this is one of the places where people could connect without too much brouhaha about their differences. You can find things that matter and that you care about, and like I said, I'm looking forward to it. Unfortunately, it's not being published until March, but early awareness helps, you know, otherwise you're going to get left out. You know, WALL-E in 4K will probably sell out before I get there.
Awesome. Yeah. Build a crowd. Is there somewhere we can start pre-ordering it now?
It's for pre-order on Amazon.
There you go.
But Have You Read the Book is the title of the book. Those are our rants, raves, and reviews for the week. Roger is not done yet, though. He has, in his devious mind, planned an intricate game that could go hours or minutes. It just depends on how much time we want to spend with it. Roger, we're going to give you the opportunity to take over the show again and play this game that you've prepared for us.
Well, thank you, Richard. And it's not every day someone gives me a devious mind, but I'm gonna flex that all day. You know I will. So, yeah, so we can continue this game for as long as it feels fun. And I am going to just admit right up front, I don't have a clever name for this. It's not high concept. I'm actually cribbing a little bit from another podcast from Doug Loves Movies. Are any of you listeners to that podcast or were listeners?
Oh, yeah. Big fan.
Back in the day. So he likes to play something called the Leonard Maltin game. Which we're not going to play an exact replica of, but here's how it works. So I have collected for you some of the best works of Russell Crowe, and I am currently staring at all of their IMDb pages. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the year of release, and just like Doug Benson does, I'm going to start reading the credits, the top 10 credited actors from the bottom up. And as soon as you think you might know what the movie is, feel free to, I think it would make sense for us to buzz in with our names. Does that make sense, Richard?
Yes, that's the way to do it.
That's the way we do it. So as soon as you think you know what this movie might be, by all means, chime in and I will call on you. And if you get it right, you get a point. Here's the catch, though. You can only guess once for each movie. So wait as long as you want, but make sure you think you've got it when you buzz in. So does that make sense to everyone?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think this first one it should be pretty easy. Let me read at least the first name. Tell you what, if you're one of those Russell Crowe people who I can just say the year and you know what the movie is, just humor us for at least one name and then buzz in. So here we go. This is a 2022 release. Reading from the bottom, Dave Bautista.
Snick.
Steven.
Nick, I heard your name first.
Thankfully. Thor, Love and Thunder.
That is correct. The much, some loved, much reviled, apparently, movie here on the Lam. Okay, so we understand how the game is played. Let's continue. This is a 2000 release. And I will read from the bottom up. Thomas Arena.
Steven. I'm only doing it by the year, but I did wait. Is it Gladiator?
It is Gladiator. Yes. Well done.
That'd be the only one I get. So.
I did rearrange the list. I rearranged the list to, not going to lie, maybe give you some of the easier ones up front. Not trying to take anything away from your achievements so far, but things are going to get a little harder. Okay, so here's a 2013 movie. And reading from the bottom up, Kevin Costner, Christopher Maloney, Richard Schiff, Harry Lennox, Andrzej Trau, Russell Crowe, Diane Lane,
Jess. Man of Steel.
That is, yeah. Man of Steel, with, ooh, Russell Crowe playing Jor-El, father of Superman. Well done. Okay. 2016. Here's our next movie. 2016. This one's going to be pretty tough, I think. Here we go. Muriel Tello, Lois Smith, Bo Knapp, Keith David, Yaya. Richard? Richard?
Is this The Nice Guys?
It is The Nice Guys. Wow. I'm so impressed with you all. So four movies. You each have 1 point. Well done. I forgot to start my timer. I don't know how long we've been going. Okay, so well done. I have several more, so let's see how we do. This is a 1999 film. Bruce McGill, Colm Feore, Stephen Tobolowsky, Debbie Mazar, Lindsay Krause, Philip Baker Hall.
Richard. No.
Jessica.
Richard first, or Jess.
Give it to Jess.
LA Confidential.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's not correct. I'll keep reading. Diane Venora, Christopher Plummer,
Steven. Is it The Insider?
It is The Insider. Yeah. Well done. There were only two more names left, and one of them was Russell Crowe. Okay, here we go. This we're going to continue going back in time. This is 1995. So here we go. Pat Hingle.
Richard.
Whoa. Okay.
This is my movie of the month earlier this year. This is The Quick and the Dead.
You are correct. Well done.
Okay.
All right. How about 2005, moving a full decade forward? Here we go. Patrick Lewis or Louis. Ariel Waller. Connor Price. David Hubbend, Bruce McGill, Patty Considine.
Steven. Is it Cinderella Man?
It is Cinderella Man. Well, yes. Done.
What a lie.
I know more about Russell Crowe than I thought.
You do. We're about halfway through our list, and if you're keeping score, Steven is in the lead with 3 points. Richard has 2. Jess and Nick are tied for third place with 1 point each.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. 1997. Paul Guilfoyle, Matt McCoy, Ron Rifkin, David Strathairn, Danny DeVito.
Jessica. Richard.
Yes.
LA Confidential.
That's LA Confidential. There you go. I feel like you deserve to atone for that. So this seems like karma that you should be able to come in with that one. All right. Here we go. 2012. And let's see. David Huddleston. Samantha Barks. Aaron Tveit. Eddie Redmayne.
Jessica.
Yes.
Les Miserables.
That's correct. Ooh. Strong. And Jess surges into a tie for the lead. Ooh, this one. Wow. So this is probably the hardest one we've had so far. 2007. Going all the way down. Gretchen Mol. Loose Reins. Alan Tudyk. Vanessa Shaw. Peter Fonda. Ben Foster. Dallas Roberts.
Richard. 310 to Yuma.
That is 310 to Yuma, which I'm going to say is a criminally underrated movie. Whatever yes. you think about today's movie, you should go watch that, because even as a remake, I think it's pretty great.
Wholeheartedly agree.
Definitely.
Okay, here we go. This may be the most lightly regarded movie in the list. 2014. And we have five movies left. Okay, Kevin Durand.
I'm going to say Stephen.
Okay, Stephen.
Just because you said lightly regarded. And I'm going to say Noah.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry to the rest of the panel. I'll stop cluing. I'm just so happy about this game. All right, Stephen, if that's how we're going to play.
Stephen the liar.
Here you go. 1995. Let's see. Kaley Cuoco. Kevin J. O'Connor, Costas Mandylor, William Fichtner, Louise Fletcher, William Forsythe, Stephen Spinella, Russell Crowe, Roadhouse's own Kelly Lynch, and Denzel Washington.
Richard.
Virtuosity. That is Virtuosity. Wow, that was the top one. We got to the top of the list with that one. I think it is a much forgotten movie. Okay, three to go. We have Richard and Steven tied for first with four, followed by Jess with three. And Nick, there's still time for you. There's three left to go, and you've got a point. So here we go. 2003. Okay, Richard Pates, Lee Ingleby, Max Bennetts, Jack Randall, Max Perkis, Chris Larkin, Edward Woodall, James D'Arcy.
Stephen. I want to do all these in like a New Zealand accent, but I've blown my wad on that one. Is it Master and Commander?
It is Master C1. And Commander. Yeah. I've never seen that movie. Is it worth watching?
It's quite good.
Yeah,
he's got to give the full title or it doesn't count.
The Far wow. Side of the World. That's correct.
The sad thing about that is, you know, that they shit. Put that colon in there because they were going to make like five more Masters and Commanders movies after that, and it just never happened.
To make
it should be on. Do y'all ever listen to David Smith's podcast, Sequel Harder?
Oh,
it's a good podcast. He covers movie franchises. Like, he'll just talk about like all the Batman movies in a single episode. But some of the episodes he does are what he calls sequel failures, where a movie was clearly designed to launch a sequel and just didn't. And I think this squarely falls into that category.
It did. It's based on a bunch of novels, isn't it?
That
they wanted to adapt.
It's too bad. All right, two left. Here we go. Two to go. Okay. Judd Hirsch, Jason Gray Stanford, Anthony Rapp, Josh Lucas, Adam Goldberg, Paul Bettany, Christopher Plummer, Jennifer Connelly.
Jessica?
Richard.
Yes.
A Beautiful Mind?
That is correct. Oh, I don't have a tiebreaker, but I may need one after this next movie. We'll see. This is the last one, unless I will make up another one if necessary. So let me just pull that up real quick. Okay, one left to go. Richard, how are we doing on timing for this?
Oh, we're fine.
Oh, good. Okay, then in that case, here we go. No clues. 2007. Yul Vasquez. RZA.
Nick.
Richard.
Nick.
American Gangster.
That is correct. And that is our 15th and I think final Russell Crowe movie for this game that shall not be named. And I guess we have to give all praise and credit to Steven for winning the game. Well done.
I was sitting there waiting for Romper Stomper, mate.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Tell you what, that would have been the tiebreaker if Richard or Jess had tied you there. But well done. I know I gave you some clues, so we can settle up after.
All I'm going to say is coys. And, that'll mean something to you and nobody else.
Well, thank you all very much. That was a fun game for me.
And thank you for putting the game together. Steven, as the victor in the game, it is your honor to go first in offering us whatever plugs you have to share.
Oh, okay. Right. I've never won anything before. I don't know what to do. Right. So obviously I will pimp my usual Asian Cinema Film Club podcast that I've been doing for years and years and years. But what I actually pimp is that I do another I do another podcast with Emily Slade, who I know has been in these parts before, where we talk about the Barbie movies. And we're just resurrecting after 6 months. Today you'll see our latest episode has gone out, and you'll find that on the Why This Film podcast stream. And we've got a bit of a backlog, but Emily's in full editing mode, and so we're back, baby, all ready for the feature film.
Very nice. Jessica, do you have something to promote?
So I will soon be guesting on a couple podcasts, but I don't know exactly when they'll be released. But one is the Con Air podcast.
Oh.
Hosted by Jake Wood and Mark Hoffmeyer. So that will be recording sometime within the next month. I think they have about 100 episodes of that show or something by the time they get through it. So maybe if you start now, you can catch up by the time I'm on it. And I'm also going to be on the next season of Time to Rewind, the Bubba Wheat podcast, that will be talking about Buffy and Angel. They each have a time loop episode. And this was a few months back, but I was on the Deep Blue Sea podcast earlier in the summer talking about the movie Sphere. So go back and check that out. We have quite a bit of fun, and similar to Proof of Life, we talk a lot about ideas that could really help that movie along. So I had a blast doing that. But if anyone has any podcasts, I love to guest appear on podcasts. So I'm just plugging myself, as you know, maybe I'll be the next guest on your podcast if you wish.
For Jessica, a good podcast, call Jess.
Jessica, can you just, because I think I'm going to be on the Con Air podcast in a little while. Can you tell us, without spoiling the movie, like which minutes you're going to be on for?
I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. I've never seen Con Air. So.
Oh, wow.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
I did give Jay a hard time, though, because he said, can you watch the movie before you appear on the podcast? And I said, Jay, I'm a professional. I will watch the movie before being on your podcast. I promise you. So
apparently he's had experience.
Yeah, with other guests.
Yes. Oh, Nick, are you promoting anything? You got anything you want us to check in on?
Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff actually. The Exploding Helicopter. I'm on the most recent episodes. We discussed Black Hawk Down, and the one before that, we talked about 1979's Firepower. I'm going to be on upcoming episodes of the Die Hard Minute. Movie Rob himself came to my house, and we hung out in my basement, and we talked about the movie. We had it going on in the background. It was a whole lot of fun, and I got together with Mark Hoffmeyer. He invited me on a show again, and we did a Pulp Fiction Night at the Roxbury soundtrack draft. That should be out sooner than later. We had an absolute ball, and shout out to them for cracking the top 10 for podcasts about film in Canada. Big deal for them, and I'm excited.
Very good. Roger, yeah, I know that you've got something to promote.
Well, yes. Yeah, so what's brought me to the LAM is my sophomore effort with my wife, Marcy. We have wrapped now. I'm officially posted the entire run of episodes of Roadhouse Minute, which should be mostly finished coming out, perhaps even by the time this podcast airs. So if you would like to hear the best B movie of all time, dissected 1 minute at a time by me, my wife, and a panoply of guests, including Jay Kluet and Mark Hoffmeyer and lots of other people. Jessica, I'm sorry we didn't know each other at the time, because I would have loved to have brought you on for 3 good minutes of Roadhouse. And it's a good listen. You know, if 1 out of every 10 people who goes to the LAM subscribes to my podcast, then that will probably double our subscriber list. In addition to that, I will be producing 5 good minutes of the Bowfinger Minute podcast as soon as they get assigned to me. I'm looking forward to eventually coming on Connor the podcast as well. I'm pretty sure I know what minutes I'm going to be getting, because I asked for some juicy Colm Meaney minutes. And I am currently in production of a podcast that has not yet been released, but hopefully will at some time soon start coming out, which is the Speed Movie Minute, the 1994 action classic with Keanu Reeves. So.
What happens if you get under 50 seconds? Does the podcast blow up?
I wanted to call the podcast Speed Movie Minute Stay Above 60, but then obviously that's wrong. So we just decided to go with the shorter title, but that would have been snappier for sure.
What happens is the sound on your Skype drops out if you go less than 50 seconds.
You know, the funny thing about that movie, and I don't want to drag this out, in the original script, the bus was supposed to stay above 20. And then they realize that that's not exactly a compelling action movie.
Yeah, and it doesn't work well with the title.
No.
So, that all sounds great. On my site, I've got reviews of some of those classic movies. I think I looked at the list and I was talking with somebody about it. 8 out of the last 11 movies that I talked about on my site came out many years ago, including the most recent one, which was the Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan revisit at the Fathom event, which was a lot of fun. So there's a lot of old stuff that you can look at there that I've talked about in a fresh perspective. I think that's pretty reasonable. I'm going to be doing a podcast with Howard Kasner in the not too distant future for our November podcast, but we haven't, I think we've settled on the films, but I don't want to speak for Howard yet, so I won't. That'll be coming up. And I am, like many of you, I am trying to arrange with Movie Rob an opportunity to participate in his Die Hard moment. He's not going to come to my house, though, damn it. I'm so incredibly jealous. So that's what's coming up on Kirkham Movie A Day. Well, I'd like to thank all of our guests today for joining us, especially Roger for suggesting this film and championing it to our Movie of the Month status. Thanks, Roger, for being here with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I had a great time today with all of you. I really appreciate it.
And Stephen being back up for me, I really appreciate it. And thank you for being on the show.
That's okay. I didn't have to explain. It would be like watching Grease 2 and finding out that Maxwell Caulfield was the star. So. I'm glad we stuck with you, Richard.
Nick Rehak, glad to have you back on the show after a little bit of an absence. Hope everything is well with you, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, as always. Just happy to be here.
And Jess, I have to keep you in mind all the time, because you're one of my Movie of the Month backups regulars, and I really appreciate your availability when you can be with us.
Thank you. They're my favorite show to appear on. So I have done many of them, but I love the excuse to be forced to watch a movie that I, especially when I haven't seen it before. So
it's always good. Great. No problem. And you know what? It's my favorite show also. Every week, it's my favorite show. So until the next favorite show, this is us signing off. Talk to you next time. Bye.
listening to The Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on The Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Ah, now. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Ah, now. Sheep go to heaven. Goats go to hell.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.